This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Last night, Donald Trump said he wants to temporarily stop immigration from, quote, some of the most dangerous and volatile regions of the world that have a history of exporting terrorism. What does he mean, and how would that affect us here in the Pacific Northwest? KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones joins us. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
Trump would develop a list of places where people can't get visas to come here. What regions is he talking about?
Well, we don't have the details yet, and starting with the term regions is problematic in itself. Our immigration and visa system is really based on country-to-country relationships, so it seems he would be talking about countries like Syria, where screening is currently difficult. That's been acknowledged by people as up to our FBI director, James Comey, saying we don't have U.S. forces on the ground there to help vet stories and check out the backgrounds. But that's also why the resettlement of Syrian refugees in this country has been pretty slow up until now. You might recall President Obama called for bringing in 10,000 Syrian refugees who fled the conflict there this fiscal year. That started off very slowly. It's currently starting to catch up. But you could look at this in different ways. It's difficult to figure out where Trump would want to draw this list from. Would you include foreign fighters in Syria, where those foreign fighters are coming from? That could include Saudi Arabia, Russia, Jordan. Some Americans are in that group, too. You could look at the State Department's annual report of global terrorist activity that includes 12 terrorist safe havens, Somalia, Mali, Libya, Egypt, the list goes on. You could look at nations where there are terror networks that are currently operating. Parts of Europe have suffered from homegrown terrorist activities. That would include Spain, Ireland, France, Norway. Those countries that currently enjoy visa-free travel to the U.S., it could be millions of people that we're talking about here. So it's difficult to figure out where he would draw the list, what source you'd be looking at. His team has promised more details in the days to come, but I think those details are going to be difficult to look at the reality of how our immigration system works and the people that are coming here.
And obviously all of this could be of great interest to people wondering whether friends or family might be affected by all of this. Liz, Trump also talked about doing extreme vetting for immigrants to, quote, ensure they share our values and respect our people. What is he advocating?
Well, we've got a couple of things here. We've got the extreme vetting portion of it. Then you have the values portion of it. So I guess looking at values, he's talked about values that are against bigotry and hatred. It raises some questions of how do you define that? How would you give an ideology test? Who would you give that to? How would you administer it? How do you define an immigrant? And it's difficult when you look at it on a country-by-country basis because we have individuals coming here seeking asylum, seeking refugee status, who are fleeing countries, fleeing bigotry and hatred. So you can't do it really on a country-by-country basis. It's more individualized than that. On the extreme vetting piece of it, presumably he's talking about beefing up background checks on everyone who comes here, trying to weed out foreigners who might be support radical Islamic terrorism. If you look specifically at refugees, this is one of the areas that we do get heavy screening on right now, and an area that Trump has called out for more screening. Just to hit on a couple points of how that works, it starts overseas. The UN High Commission of Refugees looks at the population of refugees that can be approved for resettlement in the U.S. About 1% of those people get approved. After that, refugees go through several layers of screening through different agencies, Homeland Security, FBI, State Department, Counterterrorism Center. Syrians get even an extra layer of screening after that to check out their stories, why they left, where they came from. Can you verify those stories on the ground? It's a lengthy process. On average, it takes 2 years. So how do you increase that vetting? It was increased after 9/11. Do you beef it up even more? I think that's raised a lot of questions that will still need to be answered in the days ahead.
Talking to KUOW's Liz Jones, and she is our race and culture reporter, and I want to touch on something else that Donald Trump said. He suggested that second-generation immigrants are especially dangerous. He said second-generation status is a common thread in many terrorist attacks that have happened. And you report on this these communities here. I wonder how you're reporting, what it tells you about how comments like this land with second-generation immigrants here in the Seattle area.
Yeah, it's a little tough to generalize, especially when you look at it country by country or culture by culture. But in general, you see a lot of first generation immigrants. Really, life is about survival here for that first year and kind of getting settled in. You stay under the radar a little bit more, that the wounds that you fled are still pretty fresh. So it's kind of just getting into life here. The second generation, born here, lived all their life in America, went to schools here, have friends here, live in our communities. They tend to be a little bit more vocal, more challenging of criticisms against their families, against their cultures, more likely to take political action more and more as those generations have more time here in the U.S. So it's not a quiet generation. Just one example we saw earlier this summer, we saw young Asian Americans writing letters to their own parents saying, here's why you should support Black Lives Matter. Just as an example of them taking charge of situations or taking things into their own hands in a way maybe their parents don't feel empowered to do or might be a little more shy. They face consequences in their home countries when they spoke out against about their politics or religion or race.
Sure.
So they have this dual challenge, though, where I think second generation immigrants here do feel a sense of duty to their American culture here, grateful for this place that gave them a home. They know their parents' struggles, what they went through to come here, and then also feel a sense of duty to the culture they left behind, you know, that they value some aspects of that. So they're kind of in a middle place, but I think finding their voice.
In fact, right now you are following along with some refugee families who came to the Northwest recently, a family from Somalia, a couple from Iran, and a man from Burma. How is the current political climate affecting our refugees and immigrants?
Well, in these individual cases, I follow people who just landed here and sometimes don't have family already in the area, kind of starting out on their own. So as I mentioned, the first year here, first several years are often about survival, finding that job, learning English, where do you live, how do you pay the rent? There's a lot of that. Politics are probably more on the margin. And again, fearful to speak out. There's some have talked to me about backlash they felt from their neighbors or from coworkers who might question why they're here, but far more say they feel welcome. And I think, you know, we live in Washington State, which has a long history of refugee resettlement here and a very welcoming community from the governor to employers to neighborhood groups here. So a lot of support for their resettlement. But they also worry about relatives that they left behind back in refugee camps or back in their home countries. Is the door going to be slammed on them? Are they going to be able to come here and join them? Or will they be forced back to the countries they fled in the first place? Speaking of Syrians in particular, I think this political debate has raised a lot of awareness about the plight of refugees and about where they come from, why they're coming. And I think I've seen more, at least here locally, people wanting to help. I think Syrians coming now are getting a lot of assistance, a lot of attention, a lot of help. There's a lot of other refugees from different countries who might not be getting quite the same, but it's out there. But just in neighboring states here too, Montana and Idaho, they've struggled with resettlement, and there's been a lot more of a clash of communities there opposing resettlement and those embracing it. So a little different here in Washington State. I think we're pretty open to it, but certainly around the country, seeing it going different directions.
We look forward to your reporting as you follow, as I mentioned, those recent immigrants here to the Northwest. That's our race and culture reporter, Liz Jones. Liz, thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
And we were talking just there, among other things, about second-generation Americans. That happens to include our next guest. Comedian Nagin Farsad is Iranian-American, second-generation. She was part of a comedy tour called The Muslims Are Coming. She's written a book called How to Make White People Laugh. When she's on stage, Farsad told me she does joke about this presidential campaign, although that's not as easy as you might think.
Part of the problem for comedians with Donald Trump is that he is so very much his own punchline. Like, you can't really improve on the stuff that he says with a joke. Like, it's because it's already a joke. So in that sense, you know, he's scooping us.
Hard to out-Trump Trump. You have sort of an event you've done, Hug a Muslim. You will hold a sign out. And you've had some great reaction to that, actually.
Yeah. Basically, for the film The Muslims Are Coming, we went to Salt Lake City and held up signs that said Hug a Muslim. And then literally like dozens, you know, probably over 100 Mormons waited in line to hug this Muslim. And if you've never stood, you know, on the streets of Salt Lake City holding a Hug a Muslim sign and then receiving multitudinous hugs from really like warm and delightful Mormons, like you haven't lived. I highly recommend it. It was one of the more touching things that I think I've ever done.
That's great. You didn't get any, you know, patronizing, I want to convert you vibe or not enough. I mean, mostly it just seemed really happy to you.
Yeah, no, it was super genuine. I didn't get the sense from anyone who hugged me that they wanted to convert me or anything like that. We did get some people, drive-by haters, I like to call them. And these are haters that'll basically, they'll be waiting at a stoplight, the light turns green, and as they drive away, they yell out of their car, go back to your own country, or whatever, like horrible thing they want to yell. So we did get a fair number of those in the course of making that film and doing stuff like Hug a Muslim, but you know, that's fine.
Your book's called How to Make White People Laugh, and so for the record, how do you make white people laugh?
It involves a lot of slipping on banana peels. There's some rubber chickens involved.
We love that.
I mean, so like the little side joke there is that the thing that makes white people laugh is kind of the thing that makes everybody laugh.
Yeah.
And also that it, you know, it's sort of been my mission to figure out what makes white people laugh because it's been a majority of my audience from the, you know, the beginning of my comedy career. And then the other kind of the ideological underpinning behind why to make white people laugh is that they control a lot of things like government and space and the economy and HBO's Game of Thrones.
Tom Hanks's career.
They've done really well with that. And war. I'll mention that one too. So yeah. Because they control so many things, it's important to keep them laughing and having a good time and lubed up because if they're happy and laughing, they might start fewer wars.
Can I run a theory by you?
Please.
I may be sheltered, but I suspect that most of Trump's voters don't think of themselves as haters, that if they want Muslims or Mexicans or somebody else kept out, it's less a I hate and fear them all thing and more of a I know they're almost all nice, but better safe than sorry. I wish them well in some other country than mine. But I'm curious your take on all of that.
So, I mean, you know, in a taxonomy of haters that I very
which have a chapter.
What I have a chapter of, and it's very scientific and not at all made up by me. Mm-hmm. I call these people swing haters, and because I think what's happening is, especially with this notion of like we need to put up a wall because these Mexicans are coming in taking my job. You know what's not being communicated is like, for example, right now there's net zero immigration right with Mexico, and so there's really not an issue with Mexicans coming in and taking your job. Also, the jobs are taking or not the jobs that you've been trying to get. And it's just a whole, there's like various metrics by which that statement is wrong, but they're not getting that information because swing haters, they hate because of just some rhetoric they hear. It's not, they don't necessarily have the right information and they can be convinced, I think, to move from hating to not hating with the right information. They're like the sister to the swing voter that way. And so I think these people are salvageable.
Is that part of what you're about? Is salvaging? Or
it's converting swing haters. Yeah, that's definitely like one of my big goals.
How do you do that?
You know, for me, it's about comedy and it's about going out there and trying to use comedy for good and to open up doors as opposed to, you know, like lecturing and after school specialing and those kinds of things. Those things tend to be a little off-putting. And I feel like comedy brings you into a moment of openness. And when you're laughing, you're kind of more willing to hear something.
Can I ask you, do you have a story of swing hater converted?
I don't personally think that one joke I tell or one movie I make is going to convert someone. You know, that's not really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
you don't
all
have the antidote?
I don't have the one solution. It's, you know, but I think the way that it does work is that it's a part of a continuum and that, you know, someone might see something and laugh and then they'll see another 43 things and laugh. And then at the end of 10 years, they might feel differently. You know, I, I remember I got an email from someone who fought in Afghanistan, and he went and he did it because he really hated Muslims. And then while he was there, he kind of, despite himself, started to like meet some Muslims that he thought were cool. And he was like, okay, well, this is an exception. And then he came back and he realized that the rhetoric of hating Muslims was just not sitting well with him. And then years later, he started feeling like, oh, I think I was an idiot for thinking that. And then, you know, he was already on the road. He sees my film, The Muslims Are Coming, and then he sends me an email and says, you know, I've been on this road of realizing that, like, hating Muslims is not good and not helpful and not useful. And then I saw your movie and I realized, like, you know, this is it. I don't need to hate Muslims. I don't need to hold on to that anymore.
Yeah, well, we heard this with gay rights, the, you know, when did things change, when people realized they knew someone.
Yeah.
And I feel like in some way, you know, when you make white people laugh, it sounds overly, overly pat, but I think there's something to it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if, you know, the gay rights movement is such a great example, because if we think that Ellen had nothing to do with, you know, gay rights, or Will and Grace had nothing to do with gay rights, if we thought that these people being in our living rooms, you know, had nothing to do with our changing attitude towards gay rights, where we can say now that, you know, it's legal for them to marry, we'd be wrong. I mean, culture had so, so much to do with that, because the more, you know, people you meet, the harder it is for you to hate them.
Nagin Farsad, author of How to Make White People Laugh. Her feature film, Third Street Blackout, is available on iTunes, Amazon, and cable on demand. We're tweeting out a link to the trailer now. She talked about hugging a Muslim. How about asking a Muslim? You know, KOW just held an event on that very topic, so we're going to tweet out a video of our Ask a Muslim event now at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in today to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle pizza joints and local small businesses have been the victims of an international hacking scheme. Roman Selesnyov is the son of a member of Russia's parliament, and he's accused of stealing the credit card numbers of more than a million customers, many of them here in Washington. Now he's on trial in Seattle. Why pizza places? Well, investigative reporter Martha Belle Isle with Associated Press says Selesnyov is accused of picking on small businesses without big security systems.
From his keyboard in Russia, sitting in probably at home, this is what the prosecutors say. He basically dropped in some malware, which is kind of a virus that went into their computer systems at the restaurants. And then he was able to pull out the credit card numbers that were being used to pay for the pizzas or pasta or whatever it was. And then he took those credit card numbers and stored them on servers in different places. And then he would sell them. He had a special website where he would just put those numbers up, and you could basically, the prosecutor referred to it as some sort of Amazon.com for stolen credit cards. You could just go in and ask for what you wanted, and whether it be from different states or different countries, and purchase all the credit card data, and then those customers would use stolen credit cards to make their own purchases.
And allegedly, it wasn't just Washington restaurants, but other places. So why is this son of the Russian parliament being tried in Washington state?
Well, they had been tracking this person who went by the nickname Track 2, with the letter 2, for a while. The U.S. Secret Service had been. And then there was a restaurant, a deli, actually, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, that had been hacked. And so a Seattle police detective working with Homeland Security was asked to go over and check that out. And just by looking at the different hacks that happened at different restaurants, they started seeing patterns and connections, and seeing the credit card numbers showing up on the same servers or being sold in the same places. So by pulling all of that data together, they were able to identified that the same person who had hacked into all the pizza restaurants in Seattle area or in Washington had also done it in Idaho and even Illinois. So the majority of the cases that formed the indictment were in Washington, so that's why he was charged in Washington in the U.S. District Court in Seattle.
And this man, as far as we know, had never set foot in Washington state before?
According to the prosecutor, yeah, he was doing all of it by his computer wherever he was. He could be in Bali or in Indonesia. He could be in, you know, in Russia or wherever, and was able to work the system.
And why mostly us? Do we know?
I don't know if it's mostly us, because according to prosecutors, when they arrested him in the Maldives, he had a laptop that contained 1.7 million stolen credit card numbers. And the prosecutor said if you took those credit cards and laid them end to end from here, they would stretch all the way, you know, along I-5, they would stretch all the way to Bellingham. So it wasn't just here, it's just that's how he was caught. It just so happened that they were able to pull a case together based on hacks that had happened with Washington State restaurants.
What is the defense team's approach to this case?
Roman Sleznov is represented by John Henry Brown, who's a well-known lawyer in the Seattle area. And his argument is that the prosecution has failed to make a connection between his client and the material, all the forensic data that they've collected off these different computers and servers. John Henry Brown also claims that there were problems with the way the Secret Service handled the laptop computer after Roman Sleznov was arrested. So that will be a lot of the argument that the defense will be making.
And they'll be making those arguments for about the next two and a half weeks. Martha Bell Island is an investigative reporter for Associated Press. We'll tweet out a link to her story on the subject at KUOW. As you walk or drive past it, the Red Apple on 23rd and Jackson might look like just another grocery store in an old strip mall, but it is still at the heart of the Central District and the African-American community that once dominated that Seattle neighborhood. Vulcan Real Estate has big plans for that spot, and those plans might not include the Red Apple. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols tells us what that means to the community.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How about you?
Good.
Beautiful.
Edward Winston used to work just up the street from the Red Apple at the bakery. Now he drives here to shop. It's 11 miles from his place in Tukwila. Winston says a lot of people are very loyal to this store.
Right, we are. I mean, I don't know why they're taking it out of here, but hey, that's not on me. That's on them. Great people work here, and we have a good rapport with all of them, because that's the type of people that they got working here, and that's beautiful.
Okay, my name is Michael Moss. I'm the store director at the Promenade Red Apple.
Michael Moss has worked with Red Apple 25 years. As he shows me around the store, customers wave to him. Customers like Bama Chester and Patsy Tyler.
Can I say I love shopping at Red Apple?
Red Apple's a local chain, and it gives its managers a lot of discretion over what they stock in each store.
We carry pig ears year-round, pigtails, pig feet, any part of the pig that you can eat.
Red Apple got everything.
Yes.
And Safeway, UFC, ain't none of them got what Red Apple got.
We've actually even carried some very unique items. We carried chicken skin. But you like chicken skin. I don't understand what chicken skin. But if you think about it, a lot of people love the skin of the chicken. They don't really want the whole chicken. That's the kind of way we set up the store 25 years ago. And we've always kept it that way. We didn't really get caught up in the gentrification of the neighborhood. We want everybody to be able to buy what they want, but we don't want to exclude that one customer.
Now, those customers are upset.
And I don't know why y'all let Paul Allen buy y'all out.
Yeah.
Paul out an ass. He could have did some mess with that money.
Meat department, telephone line one, please.
We at Vulcan pride ourselves on listening to the community.
That's Ada Healy, head of Vulcan Real Estate, Paul Allen's company. Here's what Healy sees when she looks at a bird's eye view of the property.
Well, I see a lot of parking lots.
Vulcan has a pitch for this neighborhood. This place could be so much more. There could be up to 1,000 people living here, enjoying each other's company on busy sidewalks.
Real estate is all about people, and creating a great place for people is going to create a great real estate project. One of the keys in terms of thinking about this 23rd and Jackson project is the tide is going to lift all ships.
When I first heard that they were buying it, that was a big concern for me, that it was going to totally change the face of our neighborhood.
That's Lois Martin. She says right now, her neighborhood is dominated by small, scrappy businesses, many owned by African Americans. There's been a lot of change over here, but some minority-owned businesses are still hanging on. Like the business she runs, Community Day Center for Children, is just a few blocks from Red Apple. It's a business her mom started in 1963, and it's still in the same spot. But the kids have changed over the years. They used to be mostly black. Now they represent all races and colors. The kids mob her as she comes in the door.
And I don't have a pocket.
You don't have pockets on your shirt?
No.
Well, but I bet you have pockets on something else. Do you have pockets anywhere else?
This is what made me become involved in the community work. It's I'm thinking about my students and what type of Seattle I want them to live in.
But I appreciate you offering to hold it for me. Put it in my pocket now.
Okay. Martin and a group of neighborhood activists pushed Vulcan to think about the retail spaces at 23rd and Jackson in a new way. Developers usually want big tenants who can fill a lot of space. It makes leasing that space simple. But Martin says that way of doing business excludes small businesses.
You know, it has to be someplace that's affordable so that they can make a profit.
Martin's group pushed Vulcan to create smaller retail spaces so that community businesses, including minority-owned businesses, could grow there. That way, the people who actually live in the Central District could benefit from the money new tenants would bring to 23rd and Jackson.
And if we don't make those spaces available and these new developments, then we're going to lose that important part of the fabric of our community.
Vulcan listened. They're going to line Jackson Street with spaces for small, even tiny businesses. It's one of many gestures Vulcan has made to the community. Other gestures: a little affordable housing, a meeting space the community can actually use, African-inspired ornamentation. These gestures have built goodwill. Here's a typical comment at a public meeting.
I think Vulcan has done an amazing job. I'm really excited.
But Lois Martin isn't completely won over. There's space for a grocery store, but Vulcan hasn't promised to bring the Red Apple back. And that has her concern.
I just think about some of the cashiers. My son is 25. They've watched him grow up.
And so she has this question for Vulcan.
Are you really open to hearing the voice of the community? Or is it lip service?
Back at the Red Apple, Michael Moss is philosophical about possibly being displaced.
Well, you know, honestly, we've had conversations with the ownership, and, you know, it's no one's at fault. You know, Paul Allen's a businessman. He came in, he saw an opportunity.
A new development has to get higher rents to pay its own costs. Moss says Red Apple probably can't pay those rents, and it wouldn't be wise to try.
We don't want to end up having to, you know, be here for a year and then go out of business.
And so it seems likely the grocer will leave sometime in the next year.
That's going to be a big change for the community, but, you know, we've had a good time serving. Serving our community.
The employees would move to another store about a mile south. That's closer to where so many of their customers have already moved. In the Central District, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Thank you, ma'am.
As part of our Region of Boom project, we're going to be following the path of gentrification from the Central District into South Seattle, and we would like to hear from you. What is a change happening in your neighborhood? We've got a place for you to tell us all about it. Just go to KUOW.org and look for Region of Boom. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Seattle is getting a new music festival. We were just talking about one of Paul Allen's real estate ventures. This has to do with Paul Allen, too, because he is interested in helping Seattle area bands stay in the Seattle area. This music festival is called Upstream. It's going to be happening in Pioneer Square next spring. The executive director of Upstream, Jeff Vetting, says he gets sad when bands that have started in Seattle leave and become L.A. bands.
Seattle's kind of on an island up here as far as industry goes. I mean, there's so many great musicians, but a lot of the music industries are more traditional and they stay in the LA, New York, Nashville, if you're country, you know. So Seattle, we have a few music industry professionals, but by and large, bands still feel for whatever reason that they need to move sometimes to make it big. And I think that, you know, in this kind of internet age, if we shine a light on our local music scene, we can have a chance to compete, you know, talent-wise with anywhere.
How will this festival help shine that light?
Just by giving artists more exposure, I think, and also bringing the industry to town. You know, 30 years ago, some people in Austin had a great idea that they were going to try to shine a light on their local music community and started South by Southwest. I think that's worked out pretty well for them.
But does South by Southwest mean that Austin bands don't go to New York and L.A.?
I don't know. I think that they've really, you know, there's a ton of industry on the music side now in Austin. And so, you know, I think that that really helps get bands from a particular scene noticed and, you know, get them on radar. And I think that as the landscape of the music industry changes, I don't think that there needs to be these geographical centers anymore. I think people can be spread out all over, and we just want to, you know, shine a light on Seattle scene and make sure that we're in that race and we're one of them.
So it's part music festival, part industry conference. What right. happens at the industry conference part?
Yeah, so the industry conference takes place over 2 days, Thursday and Friday during the daytime. And so we want to have one discussion about an issue that's facing the music industry. And we really want to be future forward and put out solutions versus a lot of conferences we find are really state of the union, talk about what's going on, don't provide solutions. So we're really hoping that we can provide solutions to some of these things.
You want to provide solutions. One thing that might need a solution is the fact that it's hard to make money as an artist, especially with the old record sale model going away. How can artists make a living these days?
I think that there's a bunch of different industries out there, technology, video games, filmmakers that all rely on music to add to their products, and that musicians can really succeed in that world. That's why we really want at this summit to collide all of the different industries that use music in a, you know, tertiary sense. And I think Seattle's the perfect place for that. We have so much great technology, great video games. We have filmmakers up here. And, you know, that's another really attractive thing about Seattle is all of these, you know, emerging tech. If we can combine this with our emerging musicians, hopefully we can make some magic happen for our local musicians and our local technology and video game companies.
Yeah. How does it affect local musicians that they are where Amazon's headquartered and Microsoft, and there's a lot of other tech that's got a presence here? We've said that distance doesn't really matter as much anymore with the internet. So how does it affect local musicians to be local with those tech giants?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's difficult to be a working artist in this day and age as housing prices go up and costs go up. And that's one of the things, you know, that we really hope to talk about and hope to find some solutions is, you know, how can we get these working artists to make a viable living and to have a great quality of life here in Seattle? And, you know, on the festival side, we really hope to get all of these artists paid. We hope that getting them more exposure, getting them shows will allow them to make a living at their craft. Other festivals will see them at Upstream, Bumbershoot, and they'll get to play Bumbershoot and Sasquatch and, you know, going out even onto the national stage and playing some of the national festivals. We think that that's the way for a band to succeed is to get out there and play and do what they do best. And hopefully people will recognize that they're plying their trade in amazing ways.
Will Amazon and Microsoft especially elevate local bands, or, you know, they're global companies. Maybe they don't care. Like, maybe they couldn't care less.
No, I think that they have a chance to, and that's something that we'd like to bring them to the table to discuss with them. You know, we've been in talks with Amazon about participation in this festival. We've talked to certain people at Microsoft along the way.
I'm not hearing commitments then.
No, I'm not going to. I'm not going to share any commitments. We have a big rollout plan. You know how it works with
sure.
the media.
Yeah.
But no,
feed me a little bit at a time.
Yeah, exactly. So we've been talking to a lot of you know, different companies around, as well as city and industry leaders, including, you know, the Innovation Studios here at the University of Washington.
Does it matter that Seattle send musicians to greater fame? Seattle area.
No, definitely. I hope that all of our Seattle musicians reach greater fame.
Why does that matter?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question.
I mean, we consume them locally at venues, and we consume them globally, same way everybody else does. Does it matter that Seattle, you know, grunge? We all know about what happened with grunge.
Certainly.
Do you want more of that?
Yeah. I think it propels Seattle forward as a world-class city. I think that when you have world-class technology company, world-class musician, world-class artist, I think that all just looks well upon your city and makes people want to move here and increases your city economy and your region's economy. You know, I think it's kind of a domino effect. As these companies move here, quality of life is going to be a big thing to keep attracting, you know, these stars of the technology world. And, you know, having a thriving arts scene is pinnacle to quality of life, I believe.
That's interesting, because to some people, Greater Seattle is a pro-business Chamber of Commerce dream, but you're coming at it from the point of view of the artists' world.
Yeah, exactly. My dream is a community that has a thriving art scene that businesses want to come to participate in. We've talked to several business leaders as we've done the due diligence on this thing and tried to get the businesses involved. And a lot of them, you know, really want to be involved so that they can bring their employees along. Like as they compete for coders or programmers or whatever it may be, they can say, hey, we sponsored Upstream. We're cool. You want to come work for us? You know, that's the mentality I'd like to see is, you know, using the arts and the thriving art scene to make the business community more viable here in Seattle.
Is Bumbershoot frustrated with Upstream right now? Is there a competition?
No, I hope not. I hope that they see us as an ally, and we've talked to them. Same with Sasquatch. We've talked to, you know, the promoters for both of those, and we really want to be, you know, kind of musical Switzerland here because we believe, you know, what's that old adage, a rising tide raises all boats. You know, as much as we can help the emerging artist community, that just makes their festivals better by making our music scene better.
Jeff Vetting, executive director for the upcoming Upstream Festival, should be in Pioneer Square in May of 2017. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. The Seattle Police Department was in front of a federal judge Monday. It was an important step in SPD's reform. Remember, the department's under federal orders to deal with its improper use of force. KUOW's Paige Browning has been following the hearing. Hiya, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
Remind us, if you will, what led to the federal government getting involved with SPD's reform efforts in the first place?
Sure. Well, as you alluded to, about 5 years ago, the Federal Department of Justice identified patterns of excessive force within the Seattle Police Department. So coming out of that, the DOJ and the city made an agreement. They call it the consent decree, basically saying two big things: that the Seattle police would work to eliminate excessive use of force and the appearance of bias against people of color. So since then, Judge James Robart has been holding these periodic hearings like yesterday to talk about the progress.
And what are the big questions being examined in this hearing?
Well, he basically laid out two big things. First, for the first time, gave an actual timeline for how the city can come out from under this federal consent decree. And he told the city to make its own reform policy. So he outlined what he wants to see there. Namely, he wants to see a lot more citizen oversight of police conduct. He also wants to do away with this group in the SPD called the Disciplinary Review Board. That's a group led by police that disciplines other officers. The second big thing that happened at the hearing was a review on whether any progress has been made on the consent decree.
What about that progress? Did the judge say Seattle Police Department has made any?
Actually, yeah. This might be the most optimistic Judge Robart has been in the past 4 years. He applauded SPD for some big improvements, including what they're doing in training. They now have de-escalation training, crisis intervention training. He also noted that the use of force level has gone down in the SPD, but he said there's a lot of work to do in bias-free policing. He actually ended the hearing yesterday by saying, Black Lives Matter. That got a lot of attention from the crowd.
You reported yesterday that this federal judge warned the Seattle Police Officers Guild, that's the union representing SPD officers, the judge warned them not to block further progress in reform. What's going on there?
Yeah, so earlier this summer, the Police Officers Guild turned down a contract agreement with the city of Seattle. So the judge brought this up yesterday, and he said if the union tries to resist needed change when it comes to police reform, he's going to take action against the union. He said he won't let the guild, quote, hold the court and the citizens of Seattle hostage when it comes to police reform.
You mentioned one goal of this hearing is to figure out what happens next. What does happen next?
Yep. So like I mentioned, the city will be under this consent decree until they create their own police reform legislation that Robart agrees to. So Seattle's attorney said the city will propose something by Labor Day Robart said, okay, I'll respond 3 weeks later. And if that goes smoothly, the city council would have the final vote of approval. And then there's another party involved, the Community Police Commission. They plan to work with the city to create this legislation. They're big advocates of having citizen involvement in police oversight. And apparently now Judge James Robart is too, based on yesterday's hearing.
We have a path out, a timeline, and a path out of this federal consent decree. And that's KUOW's Paige Browning filling you in. Paige, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
The record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. In the news today, the Obama administration has rolled out new standards to make big trucks and buses fuel efficient. More so, anyway. The head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, says we're talking about these vehicles.
From the biggest line haul truckers to dump trucks and refuse haulers, to urban and school buses, large pickup trucks, passenger vans. They'll also cover trailers for the first time.
Heavy-duty pickups and vans would have to become 2.5% more efficient every year between 2021 and 2027, and the White House says the changes will cut carbon pollution, save vehicle owners billions in fuel costs, and conserve tens of billions of gallons of oil. One of the stories you'll hear more about this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Looking for a beach read on one of these warm summer days? How about a mystery set where it's cool in a remote Alaskan village? Here's Book Lust author Nancy Pearl with KUOW's Marcy Silman.
Nancy Pearl, always nice to have you back in the studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You have brought in a book that I can't say I recognize by its cover, but it's by an imprint that I like a lot. I'm not sure who the publisher is, that they're very kind of stark, white, black, and a color covers.
Yes, and it's Soho Press. And Soho Press has an enviable backlist of mysteries. And you and I are always looking for a new mystery writer. And for this summer, Soho Press, under a crime series called Passport to Crime, has reissued the first volume in, I would say, 15 of their mystery series. So Kara Black's first novel is there. I know that you enjoy those. So I was thrilled to see these. And I was not familiar with this author, a guy named Stan Jones, but I picked up this novel, which is called White Sky, Black Ice, and started reading it and was very, very taken with both the plot and the main character.
Is Stan Jones an American writer?
He is an American writer, and this is set in Alaska in an Eskimo village, not Inuit, Inupiat village. And the main character is an Alaska State Trooper named Nathan Active. And Nathan was born to a 15-year-old Eskimo woman and was adopted by a white couple who were teaching in this small village.
You know, there's a couple of great writers who set their mysteries in Alaska.
There are.
I think maybe the state's mysterious.
Yes. Well, it's big enough to hold a lot of mysteries and a lot of different writers. Absolutely. And I'm surprised because I do enjoy those other books and those books set in Alaska, but I was unfamiliar with this. So the plot of this begins when two men are found, both of whom have committed suicide. And their connection, one is quite a bit older than the other, their connection is that they both worked at this mining company that's partially owned by the Inupiat tribe and partially owned by this big multinational corporation. And Nathan refuses to believe that they were suicides. I mean, to have two suicides just a couple of days apart, both of whom have killed themselves in almost identical ways. And, you know, he decides no matter what, he's going to start investigating.
Okay, so maybe I read too many mysteries because I'm immediately thinking that is suspicious.
Yes, and right.
A multinational mine in Alaska, very suspicious.
Right.
It's all tied in, right?
Yes. And what, you know, I like all books with a kind of something added to them, but I especially appreciate it in mysteries where I learn something about the setting or I learn something about the customs and what life is like in that particular place. And this book does it very well.
So you mentioned that this was the first in a series?
Yes.
So there's more books
by
Stan Jones?
There's more books by Stan Jones.
Wow. I feel like I've hit the jackpot. The first in a series of books featuring the state trooper named Nathan Active?
Yes.
By Stan Jones is called White Sky, Black Ice. Ooh, I'm rubbing my hands together. I cannot wait. Nancy Pearl, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. I just love to make you happy, Marcy.
Nancy made Marcy Silliman happy, and you can find all of Nancy's book picks at KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke. As long as we're in the rural Northwest with Alaska there, let's head over to the Selkirk Mountains in Northeast Washington State, because that's where you're going to find the last 15 mountain caribou left in this state. This little herd travels back and forth across the British Columbia border. Biologist and conservationist David Moskowitz says those 15 caribou might vanish altogether. That's because logging and road building are bringing more animals into caribou country, including predators like wolves.
Mountain caribou have traditionally survived by avoiding predators, and how they did that was they hung out in a place where their, you know, other prey species, so moose and deer and elk, don't go. So when you change the habitat so that moose and deer and elk can live in the same spots as caribou, then they also bring predators with them.
So what can we do for the caribou?
In the long term, you know, if mountain caribou are going to survive in the interior of the Pacific Northwest, they're going to need a landscape which looks more similar to what they evolved with rather than what it does now. So that means places that we've logged heavily, you know, we allow it to return to a more contiguous old forest. In the short term, these caribou are so endangered that they might not actually survive the decades it would take for forests to regenerate. So then there's all sorts of much more invasive things that people are trying out to just keep caribou on the landscape in the near term. And I also would say that it's not clear that we actually are going to let forests return to what they used to be like, because the, you know, logging is a you know, part of the economy of the interior of the Northwest, and it's not something that people are willing to just give up for caribou.
Okay, well, that's its own argument. Let's say you're right, and then we're going to keep logging and not return to old forests. So that puts the caribou in jeopardy. And why? It's one animal. Why does that matter so much?
One of the, you know, kind of values of contemporary culture is that every species is valuable, and that's where the Endangered Species Act came from. The other reason that people have taken a lot of interest, conservationists have taken interest in mountain caribou, is there's a lot of forests in British Columbia that are currently protected for caribou. And if those caribou disappear, those forest protections may also disappear. Now, the protection of all that habitat is really, really important, not just for caribou, but for many other things as well. You know, these old growth forests are basically irreplaceable in the modern world. And so this is the kind of a modern dilemma we have, where conservationists have really pushed for forestry protections through the protection of an individual species, which was the tool or the lever that we had available to us. But if those conservation measures fail, then we could be back to square one in terms of many, many parcels of really, you know, amazing old forests being opened back up for timber extraction, resource extraction. Again, that's in British Columbia in particular. And so updating our, you know, perspective on endangered species management to creating management plans and legislation, which requires us to not just care for individual species, but care for entire functioning ecosystems, is really where we need to go.
Why is it important to look at the whole ecosystem instead of just an individual species?
Because species don't survive in a vacuum. Right? We all live in a community. We all live in an environment. And so it's actually functionally very hard to protect one species without protecting the entire ecosystem within which they live. You can't keep salmon alive, for instance, without having a healthy watershed in which they live in. And for caribou, it's the same thing. You know, we can do all these measures to try to keep a caribou on the landscape, but unless we protect the entire ecosystem, it's going to leave us with this really odious task of of managing wolf populations and moose populations and deer populations and managing how people recreate on those landscapes, you know, for the indefinite future, you know, which is even arguable whether or not we can do that. Whereas caribou will survive just fine if the ecosystem in which they live is functioning the way it has traditionally. So there's old forests that are regenerating and managing themselves, and there's a landscape that's not bisected by so many roads that provide so much, you know, kind of unfettered access for all sorts of species that didn't used to spend time in those mountains. So if we manage the ecosystem, if we manage that entire, you know, mountain range, that entire forest for, you know, healthy functioning, the species within it will take care of themselves. And that's really, really important for, you know, us looking at the 21st century with things like climate change and growing human populations, in that these resources will be extremely valuable for us and for our survival moving into the future. You know, we think about it as whether or not it can provide us trees for, say, lumber or paper right now, but we also need to realize that that intact ecosystem is providing us all sorts of other services, including carbon sequestration, clean water, clean air, and then, you know, just a plethora of biodiversity, you know, the value of which we may not understand for centuries. But we know that if we destroy it, it will be gone.
Sounds like you're asking humans to forgo chances to make short-term money.
We are left with a very large challenge in the modern world of balancing what we need or want in the short term with what might serve us and our neighbors, plants and animals and so forth, in the long term. And there's value in an old growth forest in terms of the lumber it can produce today. There are many people that depend on forestry for their livelihood in, you know, places where caribou live. But there's value in that same forest in terms of you know, the carbon it's locking up, and there's value in what those trees might produce in the future, and there's value in the fresh water that that, you know, forest protects, and how we as a society value these various things. It's complicated, and it definitely lends itself to taking the short-term profit at the expense of the long-term values there. And so this is really the challenge that we're struggling with in terms of conservation.
David Moskowitz, biologist and conservationist. He says he wants to bring conservation into the 21st century by focusing less on individual species and more on the bigger picture, the ecosystem where they live. We're tweeting out a link to his piece on the disappearing mountain caribou right now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon. Aetna becomes the third major insurer to pull out of the Affordable Care Act, at least most of the way. What does that mean for Obamacare? And you'll hear how China is reacting to one of their Olympic swimmers daring to discuss menstruation. That and more coming up on All Things Considered. It starts at 2 o'clock right here on KUOW.